The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 255, premium for Thursday, April 15th, 2010.
Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I am Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire on this beautiful tax day afternoon. On the other end, and I can see him, even though you can't, is...
John Efron here in Fairfield, Connecticut. And yes, it is tax day, unless you're going to extend it, which I guess you're doing that anyways, Dave. But no, I popped mine in the mail yesterday just to be safe.
That's good. That's smart, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I'd... imagine the post offices might get a little crowded as the day wears on here. So
I wouldn't even step foot in a post office tomorrow.
Today, you mean?
Today, I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. So we have all kinds of cool stuff to go through today for our first premium show of April, isn't it? Things are a little squirrely. We actually have a show number 256 coming up as the next one. And 256, of course, is a very special number to geeks. Mm-hmm. So at the end of this show, we'll talk about what we're going to do with 256 and when we think we're going to do it. So but we've got something special coming up for that. And it'll be in about a week, maybe a little more than a week because I'm away next week. But why don't we start? We've got a bunch of questions and tips, John, but let's start with cool stuff found. And is there anything to report before we dig in and hear what we have from Marion here?
No, I don't think so. Let's dive right in.
Marion says, a few remarks based on show 252. You mentioned there's nowhere you can look up all Apple recall programs. That might not be true. Check out apple.com/support/exchange_repair. And it's true. You get a lot of them there, but you don't get all of them. Marion moves on and says, I got to the site from appleserialnumberinfo.com. After I entered my MacBook Pro serial number, there was a link to the site under the repair and support section. And in case you don't know, appleserialnumberinfo.com is a great site that gives you all the information about the Apple gear you can imagine. It'll tell you, when your machine was built, what unit it was built that week. And it's actually, if you're obsessive about your details of your Mac, it's a great site to visit. So that's appleserialnumberinfo.com.
Nice. And then I found, actually off of one of the sites that he mentioned here, but this is, another place, selfsolve.apple.com/getwarranty.do. So if you punch in the serial number of whatever piece of equipment you have, allegedly they'll tell you more about it, like if there's a return program or a repair program or something.
That's not where you get whether or not your machine is still under warranty, or does it tell you that too?
I didn't try it. So.
Okay, because you can go to I guess that is it will tell you everything there. So, and that's linked from the support.apple.com page. You click on the link that says check your service and support coverage. And then, you type in your serial number and it gives you everything, and it'll tell you if you have AppleCare, how much longer you've got on that, or how much longer you have on your traditional warranty and all that cool stuff. So thank you, Marion. Do you have anything else to add to this, John, before we dig on here? All right. Andrew writes, hey, John and Dave, I found a nice little app that makes finding the mouse cursor easier when it's lost. It's called Mouse Locator, and it's at 2.5fish.com/index.html. And to be fair, we'll put it in the show notes, of course, but 2.5fish, the point and five are written out. Point and fish, of course, because there is no character for fish on our keyboards. So it's 2.5fish.com. Sends you to the Mouse Locator website.
Nice. And there's something actually built into the OS which can do this as well. I'm not sure if it'll solve the problem, but if you go to System Preferences, Universal Access, Mouse and Trackpad, there's a cursor size slider, and you can make the cursor freakishly huge if you want to.
Yeah, it's weird because it's pixelated when it does that, right, John?
Yeah, it doesn't smooth it or anything. It just gets big and blocky, but it does make it a lot easier to identify. Though I don't think that was the root of the... I think the root of the problem was whatever app was being used. I think it improperly hid the cursor and it wouldn't reveal it.
I have that problem sometimes. I use two screens on my main machine. I've got it's a MacBook Pro, so there's that screen, and then there's a bigger screen that I have next to it. And man, there's sometimes when I just can't find my mouse, and I'll move the mouse around and I just can't find it. But then when I click it, that seems to make it so that I can find it. I don't know if it was there before or not, but it certainly seems like it happens often enough and consistently enough that I don't know. I think my mouse actually does disappear. I don't know.
I wonder if it's a mouse driver, because I just know some of the development that I've done that you can, the application can, or at least Windows, and I assume the Mac is the same, is that you can react to certain events and say, okay, hide the cursor or change the shape or something like that.
Right.
And,
Right.
So I wonder if it's a tiny little bug in whatever software he was using.
Well, it could be, and it could be the same for me. That's right. Yeah. John, we're burning through these, but they are cool things. We talked a couple of weeks ago about a utility called iPerf, I-P-E-R-F, that allows you to check the bandwidth on your network. And it's a command line only utility. And we'd actually asked you, John, to make that some coding project or something, which I'm sure you're deep at work on, and we're pulling you away from that to do the podcast today. Is that right?
No, that's actually incorrect. Because what I did, well, I figured, but before starting to develop something, and again, this is kind of something in the software world, is that before you start coding something up, see if someone else has done it. And you know what, Dave?
Yeah.
Fortunately, someone had the same thought, or someone thought, "Gee, I don't want people to wrestle with the command line here." And actually, I think I put it in the show notes for that particular show.
Okay.
But there's a little thing called JPerf, which Brian also told us about, which is basically, and this is nice because it's a Java wrapper or a Java GUI for iPerf, which. Well, it's nice that it's Java because in theory that means it can run on any computer that has a Java virtual machine, which I think pretty much any modern computer, except for certain small devices.
Right, that's right, yes.
I don't even think we should even get into that.
Yeah, yes.
The battle over
whether or not the iPhone or iPad should have Java and Flash.
Well, I think someone's already decided that they should not.
I think there is no battle. I think the battle never happened.
I think we published something today, and I heard that someone's going to try to create a battle, but So what we're talking about here is apparently that there's mumblings that Adobe, I think, is going to try to sue Apple over this clause that they recently introduced, saying if you want to develop on our portable devices. You got to do, and I think it's Objective-C, C, C++, or it has to be executable by WebKit.
Yeah.
And that excludes certain...
Not WebKit, Xcode.
Or Xcode.
Yeah.
But I think it has to be parsable by the WebKit engine. I think that was another condition of the...
Did you say WebKit? Did you mean Xcode again?
No, I meant WebKit.
You meant WebKit. Oh, okay. All right.
I think that was, I'm pretty sure it was in the agreement. I don't have it in front of me.
All right.
It's out there, and I think we had an article, but I just can't see how you can force, no one's forcing you to develop for the iPhone or the iPad.
I
don't see how Adobe can make a case that they're entitled to have their proprietary Flash technology. They should have the privilege to do that.
Here's the reality, right? And I realize we're on a tangent. We know we're going to get back to JPerf here in a minute because there's some stuff we want to say. But the reality is Apple has currently and always, in as long as the App Store has existed, which of course isn't that long, but they've always reserved the right to reject any app for any reason. There is no guarantee of approval. So what they've done here is they've actually been very nice about it, and they've given at least one, and it's not the only one. They've, you know, they've got other things in there that will just automatically get you rejected. But they've put yet another clause in that says, here's yet another reason why we would reject your app. And that's great. But, you know, they could have kept that out. If Adobe wants them to pull it from the, if Adobe makes a big thing and a judge says you have to pull this from your license agreement, Apple say, great, that's fine. We're just going to leave this other clause in that still lets us reject any app for any reason. And then that's the end of it. There's no, it doesn't really matter. Apple could have done this anyway. Who knows? Maybe they already have. We don't know. So I'm not sure where they're going with that.
I mean, I suppose Adobe could do Flash in one of the approved languages.
They could rewrite. Yeah.
In C, it'd probably be a pain in the neck, or Objective-C or whatever.
Well, I mean, isn't that what they did, though? I mean, they wrote something that basically translates Flash to that, but uses their own framework to do it. And this Apple says, no, you got to use our frameworks.
That's my understanding, and yeah. I think there's another product that does the same thing that I think translates .NET stuff over.
Okay.
Anyways, back on track here.
Back on track.
You're the iPerf guy. I'm not. Yeah. You have some things to add here.
So this JPerf thing was cool because, like you said, I've used iPerf before, but I've only used it, you know, it's a command line thing, and you can get all the details for all the different stuff it does, but I didn't want to mess with any of that. I just want to test my network and, you know, good to go. And JPerf, because it has the user interface, allows me to see all these other options in a way that actually makes sense, as opposed to, you know, having to hunt through some cryptic man page. So I really liked it. I realized I was able to test not only TCP, but UDP, which I didn't realize iPerf did. And it was cool. I played around with it for a little while. So yeah, it's definitely cool. It's still like iPerf, the version of iPerf to which we linked. It still requires you to have Rosetta installed on your Intel Mac because it is the binary is compiled as PowerPC. Presumably, it's mostly trivial to download. I mean, it's open source. So my guess is, John, you could download the source and install and build a version of iPerf that's Intel native. But for whatever reason, that hasn't yet to happen. So maybe it's not trivial. Maybe people have tried and for whatever reason the compile fails. So, but other than requiring Rosetta to run, it seems fine. It does peg the CPU. I don't know if it would do that if it was an Intel native app, but maybe it doesn't matter. It is. Even with the CPU pegged, it has been able to fully soak my gigabit Ethernet here, so it doesn't really matter. Are we moving on?
I think we're moving on.
Little Skype glitch there, John, but I think we heard what you said. We thought you said.
Moving on.
That we're moving on. That's right. All right. Clambake writes, just a quick note to let you know that Hide Quick Look Panel on Deactivate is a newly added toggle in the latest version of Coingo Software's Mac Pilot. I believe that this might be the same setting as was discussed in Mac Geek Gab 249 as existing in the Secrets Pref pane to deal with disappearing Quick Look panels. And this is at coingosoftware.com, KOINGOSW. com. They're the people that also make Air Radar, which is cool. Since Mac Pilot is not a pref pane and instead is an app, it may assuage Dave's stated concerns about mucking about with the system. But note that Mac Pilot is not freeware. Mac Pilot's another one of those utilities. You know, I talk about Onyx all the time, John, and Cocktail. Mac Pilot definitely falls into that realm. It's you know, one of those kind of Swiss Army knife utilities. I always use Onyx. I recommend it to people because it's free, but Mac Pilot actually does have a whole lot more to it than Onyx does. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's a cool piece of software for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. And, as I said, while we're on the subject, Coingo Software makes Air Radar, which is essentially the replacement for, NetStumbler or iStumbler, which is the thing that we used to be able to use to find airport wireless networks, and then that went away because it doesn't work with Leopard or Snow Leopard or Intel or something, right? You still use iStumbler?
iStumbler I use it on occasion. And last I recall, iStumbler, one thing that iStumbler does that I don't believe AirRadar does, iStumbler will let you also stumble for Bluetooth devices. And I think it also has a Bonjour. And I think it has a Bonjour stumble. But I seem to recall it having one feature.
Okay.
But I think they updated it for Snow Leopard.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. Well, then that's another.
I prefer AirRadar as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's a smooth little app. I don't believe that AirRadar is free either, though. I believe that's a for pay app, but it definitely worth having if you need to do any sort of wireless troubleshooting or anything like that. So, all right. Are you looking that up for us, John? Is that what you're off doing? This is odd. We decided to turn on Skype video today as a test for something that we might do in a future show. And so John and I, for the first time on a remote connection, are able to see each other, which is a little weird because now I can see when John disappears and goes and does stuff. And previously I had no idea. I just assumed he was listening intently and hanging on every word.
No, like you, I was, you know, ADD was kicking in. No, I'm just looking at iStumbler here and I see, it has AirPort, Bluetooth, Bonjour. One thing they added, it's still current. They also now have a location feature, which is kind of interesting.
That's cool.
Right. So anyways, and they've updated it. So now, you know, it does. I think the older versions had problems identifying the specific vendor. Right now I can see that it lists here, you know, Apple, Two Wire, Cisco, or at least the ones that I see here. So, so iStumbler's still a contender, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They just released a version on February 16th. So I'll have to check that out.
It does some growl action, which is nice. I have that on. So,
Oh, that's good. I'm glad we stumbled into this conversation because the previous one was from 2007. So it was 3 years ago that release 98 came out and this is release 99.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And then next.
That's right. You found some cool stuff or something cool.
Ah, right. And this led me down a path I didn't expect. So here's what happens. As you know, Dave, you know, I ignored your advice and I got a, you know, mechanical hard drive instead of an SSD.
Right. Of course you did. But, you know, just to be fair, John, I did read an article that John Gruber likes SSD drives. So maybe you'd consider getting one.
Yeah. Well, he's another John, you know, we got to stick together.
There you go.
No, as you know, my goal was to get space and not Well, you know, I did see actually the new oh my gosh, the new MacBooks that released. I think the i5 and the i7 machines. I did look at one of the configurations, and if I wanted to get a 512 gig SSD, I think it would only cost me a cool, I think, about $1,200.
Seriously? That's cheap for a 512. I did not look at the pricing, but yeah, new MacBook Pros came out. Let's take a little detour and talk about that for a second. They've got those i5 and i7 processors in them, and people weren't sure, me among them, we weren't sure if they would ever really be able to make that work in a laptop. But those are screaming fast machines. So it's interesting. It's important to note, though, that only the 15 and 17 inch have the i-series processors, whereas the 13 inch still has the Core 2 Duo like everything before it. But
What is the are these quad, or I haven't really kept up with what's different between the i5 and the i7 versus the Core 2.
So I don't think it's any more. I think these are still dual core processors. That's my understanding of these, is that they're still dual core, but I think they just run more efficiently. I don't know enough about them to dive in and tell you all the nitty gritty.
Okay.
I assume you don't either.
No, I could look, but I won't. We don't want to deviate too much here. No, okay, and I'm looking. So the 15-inch MacBook Pro, yes. If I wanted to get a 512 gig solid state drive, I'm sorry, it's $1,400 extra.
That's not that bad, considering.
Oh no, because I looked. There are vendors that charge way. So I guess they're probably getting economies of scale. And then I see 256 gig is $750 extra, and a 128 gig is $300 extra. So,
huh.
Anyways, I think by the time the one that I have now is expired, SSDs will come down for the space that I want. But anyways, so here's what happened, Dave. So I put in the drive, you know, I did it myself. iFixit has a, you know, very nice, you know, and I've been into and out of this machine numerous times, so I'm very comfortable with it.
Sure.
So put in the drive. You know, it's the same class, a Hitachi drive, but it's, you know, it's 7,200 RPM versus 50, whatever the other one was. It has more cache, more throughput. So it's definitely a faster drive. But then it started doing something that started really bugging me. It started making noise. Now, there are different noises that hard drives make. Now, this was not the tick, 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 which is usually the tick, tick, tick of death. I don't know if you ever had a drive that did that. But if you do, if anybody has a drive where you hear a, you know,
laptop
regular...
drive.
Laptop or even a desktop.
I thought it was just the Hitachi and IBM drives that if they made that tick tick tick, that was the end of it. That's the click of death, I believe, is the official technical term.
The zip drives did that too, right?
Oh yeah, God, remember those stupid things? Actually, they weren't that stupid at the time. They were fantastic. 100 megs on a single disk, dude. Mm-hmm. When was it ever going to get better than that?
So here's what was happening. So when I'm using, when I was using the machine, and, you know, typically I'm in a quiet environment in my house here, you know, I don't have music blaring or stuff like that. But every now and then I would hear like I could best describe it as like a ker-chunk. So it wasn't a methodical ticking. So I didn't think the drive was dying. As far as I can tell, and once I researched this, here was the problem. Now, oddly enough, the other drive didn't do that. Then again, the other drive was an Apple, had a little Apple on it. So here's what I found. So there are a couple of settings that the hard drives have. Now, one is an acoustic setting, which and some machines let you set this. Of course, the Mac doesn't. You know, it's pretty much you're stuck with what you got. There really isn't a lot of software out there to let you change the hard drive parameters on the Mac, though I found one. So first I thought it was this, I think it's ACC or whatever. It's acoustic. It's basically a mode where you can trade performance for quiet.
Okay, like AAM, I think, is what it's called. Automatic Acoustic Management.
Yes, AAM. Okay. I was one letter off. So so this is for people that don't want the drive to make as much chattering, but it typically reduces performance. That was not it. And I was looking around for things that let you set that on the Mac, and I really wasn't able to find anything. Huh. But then I stumbled across another article, or actually a blog that talked about this. And there's another setting, and here's the one that was causing the problem. And I wasn't the only one that ran into this. And it's not just Hitachi. It's a few other Western Digital. I think it's pretty much any drive. I found a little, and it's called APM is the parameter. And I think that's Advanced Power Management.
Yes.
And here's what happens.
Yeah.
And it's similar in that you can trade power management, aggressive power management, for performance. And apparently, as far as I can tell, what happened is that this drive, which, you know, was not did not have firmware flashed by Apple, apparently when it wakes up, it's in aggressive power management mode. And one thing that it does
from the manufacturer.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's the default. And one effect of this is that if the hard drive's not doing anything for a while, it's going to say, well, you know, I think I'll move ahead to a nice safe place.
Sure. And that's what hard drives do, is they park the head and then go to sleep.
Here's the problem, though, is that this feature at its default setting was battling with the fact that the Mac, and I think pretty much any machine, is always... Oh, and I also switched over to iStat menus.
Oh, wait a minute. You can't just drop a bomb like that in the middle of this? All right, continue, and then we're going to revisit this, John.
I'll tell you why.
No, finish on your hard drive thing, and then we'll come back to iStat.
Right. Well, I used iStat menu, so I could have used menu meters, but I used it to observe the fact that the Mac is always, every few seconds, even if it's ever so brief, and I think it's probably writing the system logs or something like that, is that it's always writing every few seconds. Again, it may not be a lot of data, but something's always happening in the background. I confirmed this with menu meters.
Okay.
So I think what's happening is there was a little battle here, is that the hard drive was like, no, nothing's happening for a while. I think I'll park the head. And then the OS wrote to it, and it's like, time to wake up again. And it would result in this annoying frickin' ker-chunk sound every 15 seconds or so.
Whoa, that's a lot.
And it was bothering me. It was really, really bugging me. It wasn't, you know, loud, but it was annoying because my last drive, which, you know, came with the machine, didn't do this. So I found this little piece of software that this guy wrote here. And if you go to, and it's called HDAPM, Hard Drive Advanced Power Management. And it's a little command line deal. McKinlay, McKinlay.net.nz. I'm going to guess is New Zealand.
Yeah.
Developed this little program, and it does one thing, and it does it very well. It lets you, and he even includes a plist file that lets you start it up automatically, which is pretty much, so you could either run it manually every time from the terminal, or, you know, he has a file that'll, you know, start it up automatically, and you basically can send whatever value you would like to the drive saying, okay, you know, either do, and I guess the range is zero, which I guess is the default, all the way up to FE hex, which is basically, please be in maximum performance mode.
Okay, so we're setting one setting that might impact a number of different parameters in the drive. Is that right, John?
Correct. And, you know, that was my thought, and that's why I then, so basically, By using this program, it basically eliminated the Kerchunk problem.
Yay.
And I even tweeted this out, and a few people that follow me had a similar issue, and they confirmed this, and it wasn't just Hitachi drives. It was people with other drives, and they were like, you know, thank you, or not thank me, but thank the developer for coming
sure.
up with this.
Yeah.
And I think he even makes the source available, so if you want to, or I may look at this, because there are a lot of other parameters, like in the documentation for this drive, there's a boatload of parameters that you can set on the hard drive.
Well,
not just looks, power management and stuff.
Yeah, it looks like all he's doing is just sending what's called the APM level, which is the automatic or automatic power management, I guess, level to the drive. But yeah, maybe there's some more nuances that you can tweak independently of that. Yeah.
Oh no, absolutely. Because I dug into this. So, you know, there are different commands that you can send over the bus to the drive along with parameters. This is doing a very specific one, but I would suspect if you dig into the source code, you could probably play with that. I don't know.
What's interesting really to me is that you can't set this, and have the drive remember the setting. And perhaps it does, but perhaps when the Mac starts up, it issues a different command to the drive. Is there a way with this to pull what the setting was?
I think it only reports if, I don't think so. I think it's only.
Okay. Because what I would be curious of is if you go into, you know, when you go into Energy Saver, there's a checkbox, System Preferences Energy Saver. There's a checkbox that says put the hard disks to sleep when possible. And I wonder if this is the reason that Apple is, you know, reading this setting and on boot, sending a command to the drive saying, hey, you know, go and be in very aggressive power management mode. And, you know, and it's up to the drive to decide at what point that is. And with some drives like the one you have, it's too aggressive. And so you want to back that down a little bit.
Yeah, I turned that setting off, and it still made no difference.
Didn't make a difference. Okay. Well, that answers my question.
No, but it can on some. And we suggested that to some folks that, especially with people that have issues. Some drives,
We got to pause things for a second here. All right, we've recovered from Skype CPU problems. So go ahead, John.
Okay, but no, what you mentioned is certainly another thing to try because I think with some drives, it may cause that if it's, if the OS is telling the drive to sleep, you'll get this Kerchunking.
Sure.
So anyways, I just want to share that with people who, don't like to hear these little chattering noises from the hard drive. I'm
going
to have it be silent. This program should work with any ATA or SATA hard drive that has APM, which is a feature that most of them do.
I can't imagine there's standard. Any drives. Current drives that don't support APM, they'd be, laughed out of the business by Greenpeace or something. Mm. Well, you can't walk into Macworld Expo without seeing people picketing because, whatever. And perhaps it worked, right? Because Apple's machines are greener than they used to be. I think Greenpeace still finds something to complain about, but it's a good direction.
I think they actually got the nod recently because they're reducing the amount of nasty chemicals that'll kill you and stuff like that, using nice metals and
One thing that looks cool on those new Macs, and I do want to research i5 and i7. I did a little quick glance at a chart here while we were talking, but I didn't have enough time to read and absorb, so I don't want to go down that path without being informed. But the interesting thing is the battery life that Apple's reporting on these, you know, 10 hour reported battery life on the 13 inch and, you know, 8 hours on the biggest, manliest, you know, 17 inch machine. So that's impressive if those numbers are right. I like that. That's good. All right, John. So before we move on to some of the questions that we have queued up here, there's one thing we have to discuss, though. You've made so there's massive changes going on in your life right now. I half expected you to come online and have shaved your head and be bald because
that's next week.
Okay, good, because that's a minor change compared to moving from Eudora to Mail or moving from Menu Meters to iStat. You've been so tell us about this most recent one. What prompted the iStat change?
Well, after I made this change, I was concerned that this power management mode may be running the drive too hot. And then here's where I made the realization that my setup was probably not the best, is that Menu Meters does not have the facility to report temperature.
Right.
So I was running both Menu Meters to give me some information. Then I was running this other thing called Temperature Monitor to do temperature monitoring. Now, in its defense, Temperature Monitor is a more sophisticated program, is that it can do historical graphs and all sorts of wonderful stuff. But I didn't need that. I basically just wanted to have something that would tell me, was the drive running too hot? And the answer is it really wasn't. I mean, the drive, you know, even with this new setting, is still running at, you know, high 90s or, you know, 100 degrees or so, which is what I've seen it run at before.
Sure. So, okay, well, that's good. Yeah, that's actually, that's smart, man, to keep an eye on that. That's good.
Yeah, so I like it. It's very flexible. You know, I like the way you can customize it. I'm not running all of the features, but you know,
sure.
I'm running pretty much the ones I was doing before, including temperature.
Yep.
And I like the fact that it gives you a lot of flexibility. For example, I thought that the text labels were kind of hokey, so I don't have those, and they also kind of take up space, which is kind of, you know, unnecessary.
Yep.
Yeah. But I know it's the CPU meter or the temperature, so. To me, it's a, you know, I got a more efficient operation now, and that I'm using a single program versus two programs.
And I know I've mentioned this before, but I just wanted to point it out to you, is that in iStat menus, and of course, you know, the assumption being made here is that you can't possibly run your machine without either Menu Meters or iStat menus. It's not if, it's which, right? But in the RAM and CPU menu, if you click on it, the thing I love is that I can see the top five either CPU hogs or RAM hogs listed and updated, you know, every second, right there in the menu. So I don't have to go and run Activity Monitor to see what's chewing up all my CPU or all my RAM. And that I love. That's one of my favorite features, and I have trouble living without it on a machine that doesn't have it. Yeah.
And I like also the temperature. I didn't know, but there are way more temperature sensors and voltage. Well, they have temperature and voltage, but there's way more than I thought. Like, it has the individual cells in the battery. So I guess that would be a good diagnostic tool if you think that, you know, a cell in your battery is defective, which is sometimes what causes, like, we've heard problems people had them before where their machine typically will just shut off for no reason. And I think it's usually due to a damaged cell. So this shows the voltage of all the cells. And, you know, on my machine, they're all the same. And I think that's the way it should be.
I never noticed that. I'm going to have to go check that out on my MacBook Pro. I never realized it reported cell voltage.
Oh, and it even has voltages of the CPU, GPUs and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm sold. And I know you mentioned, I think in the past, this program was kind of a CPU hog, but
doesn't matter.
Yeah. Not on this machine.
Yeah, it still is, but not in a way that matters anymore. CPUs got faster. And I keep deferring our questions because we talked about 10.6.3, Earlier this week, Apple released 10.6.3 version 1.1.
Huh?
Yes.
I didn't get it.
Well, and that's because you don't need it. Yeah, that's right.
I know.
So the update is for people who updated to 10.6.3 from 10.6.0, which, of course, is me, because, you know, as you remember from the last show, I upgraded my daughter's machine. I brought it back to 10.6.0 and then upgraded it to 10.6.3. So now I have to decide if I'm going to muck with reinstalling a combo updater on that again. But that's who it's for. And the answer is, if you need it, software update will tell you. So if software update, if you run software update and it doesn't, you know, it says everything's good, then everything's good. Don't worry about it. So that's the answer on 10.6.3.
Huh. Maybe you should do what I do, Dave, and just, you know, do software update.
I use software update, and that's what caused my problems with my daughter's Hackintosh. Yeah. I don't know why I bent that rule. Stupid of me.
Yeah. I was frantically looking for this update because I saw a number of people say, hey, a new 10.6.3 is out. And I kept running software update and it wasn't happening. And then, I saw the follow-up article I think we did today saying, well, if you don't need it.
Yeah, Apple was tight-lipped about it, and then this, you know, knowledge base article just sort of appeared. But, you know, their PR people were like, we don't, you know, they don't know. So, all right, on to Rick. Rick asks, Dave, in the past, you have suggested putting the users folder on iDisk. Recently, you have changed your suggestion to Dropbox. Can you please elaborate on how you suggest setting that up for us? Okay, this is interesting because there's a possibility here using either iDisk or Dropbox to have your documents automatically synced to all your Macs, which is really, really cool. So I used to use iDisk, and the reason that I moved from iDisk to Dropbox is one thing, and I continue to pay for iDisk and I just don't use it, and it kind of drives me crazy, is that on my Mac, the iDisk is stored as a disk image, whereas Dropbox just applies to a normal folder on my Mac. So I don't need to have some wacky disk image thing. And you know, to be fair, the OS X mounts the disk image like a normal disk. And, you know, it sort of manages that in a fairly seamless way. Where it breaks apart is Time Machine. You're not backing up individual files on your iDisk. You're backing up slices of the disk image. So if you want to go back in time to something on your iDisk, you have to actually restore the entire disk to a previous state in time. And you got to know where to go. You got to go to, you know, users, library, file sync. I mean, it's a really convoluted thing, and it causes kind of some weird stuff. So that's why I moved to using Dropbox for this. They both sync with the cloud. They both sync with all my other Macs. And you know, presumably at some point I'm going to regret this decision because the iPhone and the iPad are going to have, you know, a file system that I can only imagine will be linked to my iDisk. So I'm going to have to kind of reevaluate that. But so that's the reason. Some specifics about it for you, Rick. First of all, I do not recommend putting your whole users folder on anything like this. That would be a mess, or at least potentially a mess. All I do is I create a inside my documents folder, because some things just like to create stuff on your documents folder, like Parallels. It's either Parallels or VMware puts all your virtual machines right in your, you know, users documents folder. And I don't want that necessarily synced up to my iDisk or my Dropbox. So inside my documents folder, I created a folder that called Dave's Files. And it's in there that I have all of my stuff synced up. And that's the folder that I sync to the Dropbox. And I point my Dropbox at that. But you could just as easily take that, you know, that Dave's Files folder and put it inside your Dropbox folder, which would be in users. For me, it's users Dave/Dropbox. So you can do it either way. But whichever way you choose, the concept is store your documents folder in your Dropbox, and then up it goes. So is that. Did I get that, John?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, another thing is that, yeah, there are going to be some probably whopping huge folders here if you do the whole user folder.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
music,
size constraints.
Movies,
sure.
Downloads, library, and library, I don't think you should. I think library should stay where it is.
Right where it is. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, you know, but it's cool. And I think we mentioned it in the last show, but, you know, Dropbox is available for free. You get 2 gigs, 2.25 gigs for free. And we've got, I'm all filled up on mine now, but I think we put Michael Johnston's link in the last show notes instead. And I'm not sure if Pete needs one, but once Michael's filled up, we'll bounce it to somebody else here. But yeah, you know, you get an extra 0.25 gig by using the link that we have, and so do we, or so does whoever's, you know, doing it. And you can get up to 10 gigs total. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have friends or whatever that you want to sign up, go into your Dropbox account and give them referrals, and you can really blast that up. You can go from 2 gigs to 10 gigs for free. And Dropbox is great. It's, you know, amazingly reliable. I've been using it for a while, a couple of years now, and it's, I really like it. It's one of those, you know, immediately install on a new machine things for me. So.
Mm-hmm. I like it for, I find it quick. I find it a lot of times quicker to use that than to use like a flash drive or something to get stuff between machines.
Yeah.
Especially if you're on different platforms, which gets to be kind of a hassle, especially if you're talking different disk formats. I find Dropbox very handy for that.
Yeah. And it's cool. It's actually important to mention, you know, you and I use Dropbox for syncing up the collateral that we have for the show here. You know, we've got some PDFs and audio files and the agenda and all that. And so once that's built, what I do is I put it, John and I have one folder, our Dropboxes are our own, but we have one folder that's in common between the two. And my guess is I created it, but it doesn't matter who creates the folder. Then you go in and into your Dropbox interface on the web and you say, I want to share this folder with other people. And it becomes this collaborative thing. And there's not user permissions or anything. It's not robust in that sense, but it, you know, it just becomes a shared folder. But it's the only, you know, John can only see that folder in my Dropbox. The rest of them are private to me. And the same with yours. I can't see anything else in your Dropbox. But the cool thing is, as soon as I put stuff in the folder, or as soon as you put stuff in the folder, it's replicated to the other guy. And we've just magically got it. And just now we had an audio comment that if we stop chattering here, we'll finally get to. And, you know, I hadn't put it in the agenda. And so I was like, oh, let me find it. And so I put it in the Dropbox and immediately John just started playing it. You know, it downloaded pretty quick and that was that. So it's pretty cool. Yeah. Time for Daniel.
Absolutely. You know, the one thing I noticed with Dropbox or something else that I tried lately is it sometimes makes you wish that you had a higher upstream bandwidth.
Yeah, it does. Because, yeah, sending big files up. The one thing that's gotten better, if you use Dropbox, you know, years ago or a year ago, the one of the big changes they've made is that they'll let you sync files. If you know, if I've got three machines that are all synced with my Dropbox and they're on the same local network, all in my house here, all connected to the same router, instead of sending it up and back, Dropbox will actually sync just locally amongst my network, which is much, much more efficient. So that did make that part of it better. But yeah, it's still. Yeah, you need more. We always need more. Right? That's normal. Is it?
Oh, I see. Okay. Enable LAN sync.
Yeah.
I think it's that feature. Okay. I see it right here.
Nice. Yep. All right. On to Daniel. I'm a happy user of Time Machine and use it with a FireWire drive regularly. A friend of mine has a time capsule and has agreed to allow me to use it in the interest of an offsite backup. However, I don't want to fill up his time capsule with anything but the most important data, i.e. there's no reason to back up my rather large iTunes library offsite, although I do keep it backed up locally. Do you know of a way to configure Time Machine to back up different sets of data to different destinations? I haven't actually connected my Mac to the time capsule yet because I don't want Time Machine to take off backing up without me having had a chance to restrict it. So I'm making a few assumptions. One is that Time Machine will allow you to back up to more than one destination. The connection to each of those destinations does not have to be the same, and it's not immediately obvious how to choose different backup sets for each destination after hooking up. Okay, so let's address some of this here, John. First and foremost, Time Machine is capable of backing up to multiple destinations, but you have to choose which destination you want to back up to manually by going into System Preferences Time Machine and choosing it there. It won't forget about, the old one won't forget about your computer, meaning that once you point back to the first one, you'll start you'll resume from where you left off. But that's it. That's the only real change. You can't have different, as far as the restrictions go, you can't have, Time Machine is opt out. That's the only thing you can set is what not to backup. You can't do it as an opt in and say only backup these three things. You have to say backup everything but, and you're just adding tons and tons of things to the exclusions list. And that list is the same regardless of what destination you're backing up to. So you could certainly manage this manually, change your destination, you know, manually update your exclusions list, tell it to back up, then change your destination back, manually update your exclusions list and back up. But that's not life's too short for that. I'd recommend using probably ProSoft's data backup. Super Duper and Carbon Copy Cloner are cool, but again, they're really built for backing up, you know, one folder or one entire drive, whereas data backup kind of lets you pick and choose. And I don't use Carbon Copy Cloner nearly as much as Super Duper, but is that an accurate assessment there, John?
Sounds good to me. Or another option.
Yeah.
Do you notice this? I remember mobile. You know what I'm going to say.
I do actually. Yeah, because I prepped this before this happened. That's right. Go. Go.
Mobile Me. So for a while, and they've been kind of slacking off lately. But with Mobile Me, they would put in your iDisk a little folder of goodies, and I think they've kind of haven't really done that as of late. And then all of a sudden, this shocker came across Twitter in that Apple has a backup utility called Backup, I think, and they updated it for Snow Leopard. I was floored. I think I actually had to download it again because I didn't have it on my MacBook Pro because I thought they just kind of abandoned it. And I wasn't really crazy about the... I think it's a good basic... I don't know if it offers... Well, it's a good basic backup program. I don't use it personally.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I used to use it all the time to back up our FileMaker database. You could set it up to do an automated thing. It was sort of weird in doing incrementals. It was, you know, the interface was quirky, but if you already have Mobile Me, it is free. You look in your iDisk, you go into the software folder, and then there's a folder called Backup, and there'll be a disk image in there for Mobile Me Backup version 3.2. And you open up the disk image, and then you're good to go. But yeah, that's right. That would do this. That's not a bad idea, actually. Of all the free options, but iDisk is, or Mobile Me is not free. But if you already have Mobile Me, then this is definitely the cheapest option to have a manually configurable backup set for yourself. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I see it has some predefined things, and then it also has custom. I guess you can get down to a level of granularity that.
Yeah, if you plan to go very granular with it, my advice is go out and buy ProSoft's data backup because you will drive yourself crazy. But if you're okay, you know, if you've spent 5 to 10 minutes in there and you got it working the way you want, you're good to go. If it's going to take you more than that, then it's probably not going to do it anyway. So,
whatever happened to our pal Retrospect?
Yeah, that's a shame, isn't it?
Did they? I mean, I used to use it for a while. The interface was always kind of... EMC picked that up.
Yeah, and they're coming back around. They have a version of Retrospect for, I think, for Snow Leopard, right?
Oh, here we go. EMC Retrospect for Mac 8.
Yeah. And, No, wasn't it? It was 8. That's right. Yeah, and they announced it at Macworld last year. They called it Retrospect X for a while, I think. So I kept thinking they were going to call it Retrospect 10, I think it's probably more convoluted than you need, but to be honest, I have not used Retrospect 8. I used to be a dyed in the wool Retrospect user with all my clients and with myself, and I tape drives and zip drives and all that stuff. But I gave up on it when they, you know, it took so long to make it to OS 10. So.
Well, that I think was their strength. And yeah, I'm looking here. So they support Leopard and Snow Leopard. I think their strength, Dave, though I think it's less relevant these days, was that they supported pretty much any obscure piece of hardware that you wanted to use for backup. Like you mentioned, DATs and everything. Yeah. I think to me, just getting another hard drive to me is pretty much the...
Oh, these days, that's the answer. Yeah, of course.
I know some people that still use tape, but I don't know if you really get the bang for the buck anymore.
It's not like the old days with tape. No, but you know, it is handy if you want to take it off site you could almost do it just as easily with a hard drive. But yeah, the other thing I liked about Retrospect was if you were backing up an office worth of computers, you had one server machine that kind of managed everything. And multi-platform clients. I could have Windows clients, but it was all managed by the server. The server had to initiate the backup. So Retrospect was brought into existence long before laptops were the most common machine that everybody had, right? So really what you'd do is you'd have all these machines that would be sitting in the office overnight, and, you know, you just back those up when people aren't there, or just have it roll through the backups during the day, and you just kind of manage the network usage. And it was great at all that. But there was always this kind of wild card of, oh, yeah, the laptops. They're always a pain to get retrospect because, you know, and that's where Time Machine totally rocks, because it's managed by the machine, not by the time capsule or whatever. You know, as soon as the machine is on the network, it says, yep, I'm good to go. I'm going to start backing up. So, Yeah. But for Daniel's purpose, I don't think that retrospect, I don't know. I guess I should check it out. It's been long enough, and I've gotten over the fact that they ignored us for so long.
Pretty can beat a copy out of them. Anyways, you know, and also speaking of Time Machine, I actually ran something. I think we mentioned in the past, but I thought I'd bring it up again.
Yeah.
Something called Time Tracker is pretty neat. I never really looked at it until as of late.
Yep.
Actually, the reason I wanted to look at it. So one,
we've mentioned it before, but you know.
Well, it basically tells you what files were backed up, because you can't tell this if you just look at the, the Time Machine backup, because it shows you everything. So this does a delta between, I guess, the two. But the reason I want to look at this was because here's what happened, Dave. Another thing about the drive that I put in here, and this was unexpected. So I used Carbon Copy Cloner when I went from my old drive to my new drive. Put in the new drive, had the same name, you know, of course, Time Machine was already set up to back up from it, started Time Machine, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to back up 160 gigs of data. I'm like, nothing's changed. All the files are exactly the same. And I stopped it because I usually am on wireless, and I'm like, you know, this is really bad. It would not. I thought maybe it was the drive label. So I even changed, because the drive label, the creation and modification dates had changed, and I thought it was keying off of that. It must be keying off of something else, Dave. Like, I think you suspected the drive serial number, because it insisted on backing up the entire drive again.
Yeah, I've heard some people talk about there's some way of making it so that Time Machine sees that the backup that's out there is from the same drive that you have on your system, and just doing an incremental, like, you know, like it's always done. But it from what I recall, it was a very convoluted process, or at least mucked about with some very, very specific things. And I think if you look in the Time Machine backup, there's some IDs, and I know one of them is the MAC address. The other is the name of the drive, but I think there's one more hidden file out there that identifies the actual drive that it came from. And it might be right. Yeah. It might be using that serial number.
Okay. Cause when that happened, I basically set that baby up. I basically took it off of wireless.
Yeah.
Put it on gigabit Ethernet and plugged it directly in and let it run overnight. Cause it did take overnight.
Oh yeah.
I'm not gonna do that over wireless, you know, doing 160 gigabytes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad there's not an easy way to just say, trust me, that's my drive, you know, but
that's all right. On to Paul.
Yeah. All right. Sure. This will get geeky. How are we doing on time here? We're at 53 minutes. I want to make sure we do Sandro too. So let's do Sandro quick, and then we'll do Paul to wrap it up. And, now, of course, I'm totally out of sync with myself. But.
Hi, guys. Sandro here of the My Phototech podcast. I was listening to just this morning to your show number 252 premium, where Jim was asking a question about pages and setting up default indents for lists. And I think if I understand the question correctly, I think I have the solution here. Well, let me just go over this. If I'm in a blank document, let's say, and I want to start a list, a numbered list, I first would go to the inspector, select T for text, in other words, the text inspector, and then click on the list tab within the text inspector. And down at the bottom, we have bullets and numbering, and I would select, let's say, numbers. and then a type of numbering. So we'll just use regular Roman numerals through these pop-down menus. Now, down further, we see a couple fields for number indent and text indent. The number indent being the actual number in the list and where and how it's indented in inches. And then there's the text indent, which means basically the distance between the number and the start of the text on that particular line. So I can customize this to my liking. Now, the question is, how do we save this in some way so that if we start creating another list here on this document, we can use these same parameters? Well, that's done by saving this as a custom style. Now, if I can, there's a couple ways to get there, but the easiest one is that little blue button in the toolbar up at the top of the pages document that we're working on. And if we hover over it, it says show or hide the styles drawer. So if I open the styles drawer, we'll see that down in the list styles, because I essentially changed the default style for the numbering list or the numbered list in this particular template, which is the blank template here that I'm working on, I can simply click. I'll see that there's a red down pointing arrow next to numbered list, and that means that a change was made, deviating from the default parameters for that particular style. So by clicking on that red arrow, I will see one option here is to create a new paragraph style create a new list style from the selection. In other words, where my insertion point is in the document, which is this new list. And so I select that, and I can give it a name. And generally, when I do these things, I'll use my initials first, and then a name, like in this case would be my numbered list. Whatever. You can have as many as you want. And that creates your own custom list, which then later on in this document you can, if you have another list, let's say, you can select it and apply your style. And so the question then is, well, how can I use this, my own style of list here, for other documents? Well, the thing is, this change that I just made will travel with this particular file. And to make it part of the system here, the pages system, so that you can use your style again in future documents, is to save this as a template. Save this document as a template. And that would be done from the file menu. File, save as template. And
we'll wrap it up there, but that's that. It was a long comment. Thank you, Sandra, for taking the time to explain that. There were many things I didn't realize were possible in numbers. In pages there. Wow. One of which was the styles drawer. I had never seen that. Apple does a fairly decent job of keeping the user interface uncluttered, but sometimes that's at the expense of actually letting you know what some features are. I had no idea. I kind of walked through this as I was listening to his comment the first time. And that's interesting. Now what he... I think what he said is, as his comment wore on, was that there is no way to do this globally. You have to save it as a template for your, for yourself, but you can't apply it like with Word. You can't apply it to a global template and just have it there automatically. So you've got to save this template and then reopen it. So bear that in mind as you're doing this, but it is possible to save, to change the default list layouts and then save them. So thank you, Sandra, for taking the time to walk us through that. I appreciate it. And I think that there's at least a sizable amount of our listeners who also appreciate it. Time to do Paul, John. Do we dive into this here?
I don't think there's a... Paul. All right. Joe. Well, we'll save Joe for...
We'll save Joe for another time. Okay. So Paul writes, I was hoping that you'd be kind enough to either point me to the previous episode in which you talked about or rehash the topic of prioritizing traffic on my LAN to give my server a constant amount of throughput while other computers on the LAN have a limited amount to do basic surfing. Basically, I've got a server set up at work, G4 running 10.4.11, which doesn't matter for this purpose, and I need to give it priority on the network to do AFP transfers to an offsite location. At the same time, I don't want it taking up 100% of the bandwidth, thus leaving the other computers struggling to just load a web page while the heavy uploads are underway. And yeah, we've talked about this before in tangentially, but never directly, so happy to address it here. There's a couple of different ways to accomplish this. For me, the most elegant way is if your router supports something called quality of service, and it's sometimes known as packet shaping. The Linksys routers do. The reality is that most of the consumer grade routers that we all have, if they support it, it's not perfect. But it's workable if you're willing to give up. In fact, I think with any of these implementations, you have to be willing to give up a little bit of your bandwidth overall to make this work. And the way it works is you tell your router, okay, here's the amount of bandwidth I'm buying from my internet provider. Maybe it's 15 megs down and 2 megs up. And so you plug that in and then you can start by prioritizing either on my Linksys router, especially with the DD-WRT firmware that I use, I can pick by port, what port it's plugged into, or I can pick by MAC address and say, okay, make sure to prioritize this computer, and you can get as detailed or keep it as high level as you want. You could just say, give my server ultimate priority and give the other computers, set the server to 10 and set the other computers to 5. Right. Or you can say, I want to give this computer a certain amount at this time. And it all depends on your router software. Again, the DDWRT software, that's a third party, it's free, that you can put on most, but not all, Linksys routers is definitely capable of this. Apple's firmware in their routers is not. I'm sure the router itself is as capable of it as the Linksys routers are, but Apple does not provide a way for us to manage this. Despite the fact that the software is probably right there in the router anyway. So that would be the best way to do it, because that way you're managing it at the point of entry and exit to the network, right? You want to have a gatekeeper, it's good to put them at the door. So that's step one. But if you can't do that, John, you had a very creative idea for this. So,
yeah. So here's this is basically the cheapskate option. Because you don't have to spend any money, but you may have to spend some money.
Sure.
I'm just going to spit it out.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to, because that'll mess up my mic. There's another way you could do this, and that's rather than, so I'm with you, Dave, is that doing it at the router is the best centralized way to manage this sort of thing. But if you can't, here's another way to go about it. What you may not know, and I haven't really done this, I'm going to try it, is that underneath the covers, the firewall in Mac OS X is IPFW, I guess Internet Protocol Firewall. Well, in addition to, and I believe this is still true in Snow Leopard, in addition to it allowing, being a firewall that, keeps bad stuff out, another feature is that it'll allow you to define the maximum bandwidth of what they define as a pipe. And I found a OS X Hints article. I'll link to that. So there are a couple of ways you could do this. So one is you could dive right in and go to the command line. And they have an example here. And it gets pretty low level. So, if you wanted to define a pipe that, for example, is 15K per second, you type in sudo IPFW pipe 1, which I guess is the pipe number, config BW, which I'm going to think is bandwidth, and then the amount of bandwidth, and then another command that attaches that pipe to a specific port. So you have to do it per port. So if he's doing AFP, whatever, I forget which one that's on, or if that's going over port 80, that's probably, is that going over port 80?
548 is.
Or it's 548, AFP. Okay.
Yeah, but port 80 is web browsing. But there is a way, this Mac OS X Hints article doesn't talk about it, but there is a way to make it system wide that you can throttle the bandwidth. So you know, some digging in ports, and I don't remember it off the top of my head, but there definitely is a way, because I've done it, to throttle the whole connection. So
okay, it's not the best solution because it's not very dynamic, but you may want to, because I think the concern is, what I'm reading into his solution here is that he doesn't want one machine to be hogging all the bandwidth and everybody else is stuck.
Right.
So maybe the way to do this would be to limit the bandwidth on this one machine that needs to do this heavy duty traffic and pick a reasonable value where you still have enough bandwidth for other people.
Yeah. Leave yourself some headroom so that, you know, the worst thing is when you're using either all of your downstream or all of your upstream. And what, you know, then even something as trivial as checking email becomes very, very slow because there's this lag in turnaround because there's no extra bandwidth to be used. So by throttling the bandwidth of any one machine, you have the ability of leaving some headroom. What's even better, of course, you know, if you do it on the router, then the router has the headroom and can manage it, you know, kind of globally that way. But yeah, no, right. IPFW will do it. There's a piece of software called Waterroof.
I had that in front of me, man. great minds think alike. I was going to mention go ahead. If you don't want to muck with the terminal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's it. That's the answer is Waterroof. It manages this IPFW stuff, but it does it from, you create the pipes there in their interface and you attach them and detach them right there. It's not the most elegant interface, but it's way better than the terminal if you're not comfortable with the terminal. And it also remembers your settings, so you don't have to, you know, create some script that does it. It just, you know, it'll do it and you can either turn it on or turn it off and it's just boom, it works. So instead of trying to guess it, oh, well, how do I do it for multiple ports or how do I do this? It you know, you just do it in the GUI. Just like we were talking about with JPerf before, it's the same kind of thing. It's a wrapper for the command line.
And it has a specific button, bandwidth manager.
Yeah,
that lets you.
It does it really well.
That'll then ask you these parameters. You still may need to understand, you know, a little bit about what you're doing here, and And I think the name is cute too.
Yeah, you know, I like that. Firewall,
water roof. Ha, humor.
Yeah. Humor is a funny thing. Yeah. So there's the band. As we mentioned earlier, this is show 255. Show 256 is the next one, and. We will be coy and say, we didn't want to do something special for show 250 because that number is not a cool, geeky number. 256 is geekier. But the reality is we didn't really think of anything to do, and we didn't prep in time. So 250 just came and went like it was any other show, which it was good. You know, that's OK. We still held ourselves to our high standards. However, one thing we want to do, John and I are always, you know, for show 100, which, of course, all you can still hear in the archives, John and I went back and talked about all the computers that we had throughout our history here. And it worked out really, really well. It was so cool. I had so much fun doing that. And I know we got a lot of listener comments for it. For this one, what John and I have talked about doing is talking about all of the ways we've connected to the internet all the way through. So that will be our topic for show 256. And I think the technology exists for us to take our Skype video and broadcast it to Ustream. So you'll be able to see us do this. The plan is either to do it the night of Sunday the 25th or Monday the 26th, and we got to figure out our schedules, and we'll post something on TMO. How's that sound? Yeah, we'll put it up on TMO. That's good.
Sure. Right.
You folks know to check TMO. Even though I'll be on vacation next week, we'll put something up on the Mac Observer on Friday. It'll be there on Friday, so you can see it over the weekend, and that will let you know when the live thing is. So
yeah. By the way, 256, for those that don't get it, we'll help your geek cred here, is 2^8. 2^8 power, because computers do everything in binary or base 2.
That's right. That's right.
Or most things.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Michael Johnston, he does the This Week in iPhone podcast, and he's also the one that converts all these to AAC for us and for you. I guess as a matter of course, we should go through the contact information, even though I'm sure all of our premium subscribers here, John, know how to get in touch with us.
But well, they may not.
That's
you know,
true.
We'll just have to remind them that if you want to call us, you should call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. You can email us to premium at macgeekgab.com.
I know you said premium at macgeekgab.com.
Oh, right? You know I said premium at macgeekgab.com, and that's what I meant. So that's that. You can Skype us to macgeekgab, and I guess that's that. I'm trying to think
if you
want to
find
else.
Out show-related events, of course. Well, you know, Twitter, I am John F. Ron. Dave is Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete, who's Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete. Wow.
It's pretty, and, pretty deep.
But
there,
also,
man.
If you want to follow, we've been getting better about this. If you want to follow show-related events, like when the shows are posted or when the show notes are done.
Or when the live show is going to be.
Right. Please follow Mac Geek Gab. And if you just want to, you know, enjoy the whole Mac Observer goodness, you can, of course, follow Mac Observer on Twitter.
That's right. Yeah. So definitely follow Mac Geek Gab, or at the very least, just check twitter.com/MacGeekGab. The time and instructions for the live show will be posted there. So we'll figure it out. It's I think it's going to work. I'm going to use CamTwist and Ustream, John, and we'll see if we can't blow the processor up here. So.
Yeah, you may max me out. Oh, well, no, you got more headroom than I do there.
Yeah, well, you don't whatever you're doing now is all you'll need to do in terms of your computer's processor.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing on your end will change. So.
Okay. No, I'm doing pretty good here. The G5 still has a little life. I'm right now in about 75% on both cores.
Okay.
And I'm using the iSight over FireWire, which seems to be working just fine.
So far, so good. Yeah. All right. Let's get out of here. That's it. We're done, right?
Yes, sir.